Walter, welcome to the Odd Years. I am fascinated by the politics of North Carolina. In the last 13 elections, only two Democrats have won there, Jimmy Carter and then Barack Obama back in 2008. And yet it is still an incredibly competitive state. That's the story this year. When Joe Biden dropped out and Kamala Harris became the nominee, the dynamics shifted. The race between Harris and Trump, and the race is now very close. The Biden campaign earlier in the year had suggested that they were going to make North Carolina a priority, but as his numbers started to slip nationally and overall, it was pretty clear that North Carolina was off the map. Harris has put it back on the map. And yet, it's still neck and neck. And it's going to be a key battleground state in 2024. So today, I've invited someone who knows North Carolina as well as anyone, Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College in Salisbury, to help us understand the political dynamics of the state and to answer the question that so many of us have, which is, can Democrats really flip the Tar Heel State in 2024. Michael Bitzer, it's so great to have you with me. We communicate often, but I never get to see you face to face. So this is fantastic. Thanks for joining me.
It's a real honor and privilege. So thank you for the invitation.
Let's just start with the big picture here. I do feel like we talk a lot, but it's really every 4 years that we really up our communication. And it's usually one way. It's me saying, okay, Michael, you know, last time we thought this was going to be close, or Democrats say this is the year they're going to flip the state, and they don't. They get close, but they don't. Is this year different?
So, yes, the past several cycles, North Carolina, particularly since 2008, has been what I lovingly refer to as a stuck battleground state, that the dynamics and the fundamentals of what we see after the election paint a pretty consistent picture of what happens in North Carolina. We are evenly divided. If you take all of the federal races since 2008, we're basically a 51-49 Republican state. Mm-hmm. You take all the council of state races, which are all the executive statewide level races, we're a 51-49 Democratic state. So it has been kind of consistent in this regard. I'm getting the sense that 2024 may finally be the breakout point, because I'm seeing on the ground, and of course the energy level, is very much a different dynamic than what we have seen since 2008. I'd point to something like Harris's 25 field offices across the state, which I believe are more than what Barack Obama had when he flipped this state in 2008. I think we're seeing, you know, a modest spike up in Democratic registration among new voters, but it's still dominated by the unaffiliated voter, the voter that doesn't choose a party registration in this state. And, you know, the amount of money that's going to get dumped into the state between now and November 5th is just astounding in terms of what we're seeing already booked. So if there's a year where it feels like, yes, indeed, the script can get flipped and that stuck nature of North Carolina could eventually flip, it feels like this year is the year.
That's the perfect encapsulation of where we sit now. Talk to us about the difference between the 51-49 Democratic advantage in those state level races and the 51-49 advantage for Republicans on the federal level. What, talk about that Venn diagram.
Yeah, that has been a fascinating dynamic in North Carolina, and it's been true since really the Southern realignment from the solid Democratic South to what was eventually the solid Republican South. And I would point back to 20 years ago now, the 2004 presidential election in North Carolina. George W. Bush won this state by 12 percentage points. Wow. It was not a blowout of, it was not a competitive swing state. It was a blowout state. On that same ballot, the Democratic governor running for re-election, Mike Easley, won by 12 percentage points. So you had a 24-point swing from the presidential down to the gubernatorial contest. That swing voter in North Carolina was predominant. It was kind of our bipolar electoral dynamic at play. But that 24 points has collapsed now, I argue, to 3 to 4 percentage points.
Yeah.
So the new math is really 97% of the electorate is locked into one party over the other. 3% are those persuadables, the Trump presidential voter in 2020 flipping to Cooper in the governor's race in 2020, and they're mostly in the urban suburbs and in rural counties.
Well, first of all, just an acknowledgement of that swing is just phenomenal, and I think you're right. We're seeing that all over the country. It's not unique to North Carolina, where there were times where you could run as a fill-in-the-blank state Democrat or Republican, even though your state at the federal level went the other way, right? They would say, I would never vote for a Republican for president, but we know he's a Maryland Republican. She's a, North Carolina Democrat, different from a federal Democrat. So let's talk about that swing voter, that voter that went for Donald Trump, but also went for Roy Cooper in the 2020 election. And is that swing voter the key to this election, or are there other voters that may be important that weren't necessarily part of that very narrow coalition of Cooper voters?
Yeah, I think that is one major factor, but to me, there's a second major factor at play in North Carolina, and that's the core base voter, particularly for Democrats. You know, when you look at things like turnout rates among party registration in this state, take, for example, in 2020, we had 75% of all North Carolina's registered voters show up to vote. That was a record for us. But when you look within the dynamics of party registration, Republicans were 6 points ahead of that 75%, and registered Democrats were only at the state average. So you've got this built-in advantage, and we've seen this over the past several election cycles. Registered Republicans, 6 to 7 points ahead of the state, registered Democrats at the state average. I think this year, registered Democrats are probably going to exceed the state dynamic. And if that is the case, they can lose parts of that 3 percentage points of swing voters if they have the truly committed to show up. And we're talking about urban Black voters, also rural Black voters as well. And most importantly in this state, voters under the age of 40, millennials and now Gen Z, who traditionally have the lower voter turnout, they're at the table, they just don't participate. They don't come to the buffet and eat from voting and casting their ballots. So to me, that dynamic of where those swing voters are, yeah, they're persuadable, but if you can focus and bring out your core base who are reliably voting for your party, maybe you can shave off a point of those swing voters and compensate for those truly reliable voters.
That's really interesting. I know that the new Democratic Party chair she's what, 25, 26, something
She's
like that?
26 now. She was
Yeah.
25. Anderson Clayton,
Yes.
the youngest party chair in the United States right now. When she was elected 25, she's now 26.
Okay, so still the youngest, I'm sure,
Yes.
even at the old age of 26. But a lot of folks, at least in political circles, on the Democratic side, pointing to her as part of the reason why you're seeing this increase in the number of campaign offices, Democratic campaign offices. And to your point about increasing turnout of the base, that seems to me where she's really been focused. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, and she has made it a point. She's from rural North Carolina, and she understands what has happened in the rural realignment in this state, that white rural voters have moved more and more Republican. But in North Carolina, particularly in the eastern part of the state, you have a large number of majority minority counties where black voters make up substantial numbers. But their turnout again has been lower than expected. So she's been focused on that. I think certainly the Harris campaign has also been focused on black voters in cities like Charlotte, like Raleigh, Winston-Salem, and Greensboro. And if they can elevate those numbers and be competitive in what I call the urban suburbs and the surrounding suburban counties. That's a kind of combination that when you're talking 1 to 2 percentage points, and remember, Donald Trump only won this state by 75,000 votes. It was the closest Republican win for him in 2020. You get 30 extra Democratic votes out of every precinct in North Carolina, Joe Biden wins in 2020.
And in this case, obviously now it's Kamala Harris wins. You sit on a college campus, you're at Catawba College, so you are surrounded by young people every day.
Yes.
Do you have the sense that they are more engaged this time around? To be clear, 2020 was obviously the dynamic of COVID was at play. I don't know what your college's situation was with students being on campus or not, but clearly, I think a lot more schools now, students are on campus than they
Oh,
were
yeah.
in 2020. But what we're hearing and seeing in the data suggests that young voters still are kind of meh on Harris and on this election. So what are you hearing and seeing where you sit?
I think that that is an accurate general description, but I think where young people are, and I have this conversation almost daily in my classes, is that we have to remember that these folks, particularly Gen Z, but also millennials, but current college students are the children of polarized politics. They have known nothing other than the two parties truly at loggerheads with each other. And I think certainly since July 21, to me, this year's election, there's a pre-July 21 and there's post-July 21.
Me too.
And I think post-July 21, seeing somebody who's younger, who's making an active push towards younger voters with some issues that, yes, indeed, they resonate with and are concerned about. I think that they're starting to tune in and pay real close attention. During the first presidential debate, we had a watch party in one of our auditoriums, and we had probably well over 100 students, which I, if you had told me beforehand how many folks are going to show up, I'd say, well, 20, 25, maybe 30 if we get there. It was well over 100. And the interesting dynamic was when she was speaking, I could tell students from both sides of the political aisle were completely quiet and listening to what she had to say. They want to hear from her. They've known Donald Trump for how many years now?
For many of them, they've known nothing else, right? This has
Exactly,
been their
exactly.
entire political experience.
Exactly. And I think what they were wanting was, what is she going to do to speak to my concerns and my issues that are most prevalent? And, you know, it is a renewed sense of, okay, I do have potentially something that I can vote for, but not necessarily vote against.
Great point. Now let's talk about these voters. You talked about the exurbs, so the suburbs right around major metro areas in the state, and then urban Black voters. Now, where Trump has found some success, we've seen this around the country, but he did better in some of these urban areas, in heavily minority areas, whether it was with Hispanic voters or Black voters. We're hearing and seeing a lot about young Black men, especially, who are attracted to Trump. Either they voted for him in 2020 or they're thinking about voting for him in 2024. Can you talk about that and what you think is going on there?
I think certainly North Carolina, like a lot of dynamics, does have national implications and dynamics at play. We're kind of a microcosm of a lot of what's going on in American politics. And I think certainly the concern about Black men in particularly, who tend to be more ideologically moderate or even socially conservative, I think they're seeing kind of Trump's appeals to them as something that they would find of interest. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to be, I think, the critical component is, how much does the Harris campaign work to solidify that dynamic and especially potentially boost African-American women to show up to vote? That was actually the group in 2022 in this state, when we had Democrat Sherry Beasley at the top of the ticket, an African-American woman running for the U.S. Senate. It was Black women who had one of the lowest turnout rates. So that kind of dynamic of descriptive representation on the ticket versus substantive representation based on policies, I think North Carolina is going to be a great test case to see how that dimension plays out for particularly Black voters in urban North Carolina.
And then the suburbs outside of the major cities. And this, I was just in Asheville a couple weeks ago, and I don't think you can appreciate it, this, what North Carolina is, until you experience this. But to go from downtown Asheville, which is probably D plus 80, right? It is incredibly liberal.
Yes.
And then you don't have to drive very far.
Nope.
Maybe 2 or 3 miles, and you've got Trump flags everywhere.
Everywhere.
So it feels like what North Carolina is, to your point about the areas around an urban area, it's like you're in the urban area, it's dark blue.
Mm-hmm.
You drive a couple miles outside and it's dark red, and there's not as much purple, which is what a place like where I am in Virginia, you know, there are purple areas. The further you get out from the center of the city proper, it gets a little more purple until you get further into the rural areas where it's red. So why is North Carolina so different? How come there isn't that sort of purple buffer between the urban and the not urban?
Yeah, there. I think, you know, we oftentimes nationally talk about the suburbs or the competitive battlegrounds of national dynamics. And we have that, but it's in a very contained area in North Carolina. So I describe the very competitive nature of North Carolina politics as being distributed among 4 different regions of the state, 3 of which are lopsided to one party over the other. So like nationally, if you take all of the central cities in those urban counties, the Charlottes, the Raleighs, the Greensboros, the Ashevilles, add up all their votes, it's a 70-30 Democratic dominance among those cities. Mm. When you cross over a county line into those surrounding suburban counties to Mecklenburg and to Wake County, they are basically a 65-35 Republican area. They are the most Republican area in the state. You move then into rural North Carolina, it's generally 60-40 Republican. The one area that is truly competitive are inside the urban counties, but outside the major city limits. So in Mecklenburg, you've got Charlotte, which is kind of the dominant area, but you've got places like Huntersville, like Pineville, like Mint Hill. Those are the competitive suburbs within North Carolina politics. And actually in 2016, they went 50-50 between Clinton and Trump. In 2020, they went 53-47 Republican, but they are the most competitive areas in the state. And so a state that is so competitive really only has pockets of blue kind of scattered within the urban counties, but outside those major city limits, everything else is dominated by one party over the other.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Michael Bitzer. Cook Political Report subscribers love their insider access to Amy Walter, David Wasserman, and the rest of the editorial team, and there's no time like the present to join us. In fact, registration to our live 2024 election preview is now open for all annual subscribers. Follow our presentation on key races and the political dynamics of 2024. There's also going to be a Q&A session at this live event. If you're interested in attending and unlocking all the access and benefits of a Cook Political Report subscription, go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. We hope to see you on October 2nd. Now, I think for those of us who don't live in North Carolina, our assumption is, look, this is a fast-growing state. Yeah. And so the people who are living in those urban suburbs, right, outside the center, but right, basically right next door. These are transplants. These are folks who've moved down recently. So they're not going to be quite as parochial as traditional North Carolina voters, or that the moves into North Carolina are from the kind of people who've been traditionally good for Democrats, college educated voters.
Yes.
Talk to us about how much that conventional wisdom is right or wrong about the kinds of people who've been moving into North Carolina and shaping the competitiveness of this state.
Yeah. So we are well over 10.5 million residents within the state. We're now up to 7.6 million registered voters. And actually, North Carolina natives are now the slight minority within that voter registration pool. So we are continuing to see the very expansive growth happening, particularly within those urban counties. Within those central cities, people are moving to, but they're also moving to those urban suburbs. And a really fascinating dynamic that I've just kind of teased out in the data, if you look at the distribution of voters across the state based on those four geographic areas, in 2020, a quarter of all the registered voters lived in those central cities. Mm-hmm. Now it's over 30% of those voters live in those central cities. And the urban suburbs have dropped from 30% down to 24%. So there's been this tectonic shift occur in just 4 years within this state. And if you start to pack in the natives versus non-natives, that dynamic is also shifting as well. So, you know, there's a lot to be digested after the election in this state. But I think we're kind of, it feels like we're at some kind of tectonic shift going on. And when those plates rub up against each other, usually you tend to get some rumblings of a political earthquake. And, you know, how that's going to play out come November 5th, I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows at this point. But all the plates are kind of really lining up against one another, and something is going to shock the system.
The other thing, when I think about who's moving to North Carolina, you're right, a lot of them, maybe they're moving to the Research Triangle for jobs, or they went there for school and stayed. Maybe they're retiring out in Asheville. But you've also got a lot of retirees, and I would argue maybe more conservative leaning, in Wilmington. Yes. And that part of the state. So it's kind of balancing it out, right? For every sort of liberal person who moves to Asheville, you've got a conservative person moving to Wilmington. Is that?
Yeah. That Wilmington area, I think, is really, and the county is New Hanover County. And I think for a lot of us who study and watch and kind of think about, okay, where's a kind of prototypical dynamic of a county that may give us some clues? New Hanover is a perfect one. And I think, you know, with the influence of people who move from the Northeast down to Florida, it's too hot in Florida, so I want to move. I don't want to move back to the Northeast, so I move halfway. Boom, Wilmington. Yes. New Hanover County, and that, you know, coastal area of North Carolina has been experiencing the growth.
That brings me to, I'm so glad you noted watching for New Hanover County. So election night, take us there. It's already making my stomach hurt a little bit thinking about what election night is going to feel like, oh my gosh. But as we're watching returns, well, first tell us this. Given what you have seen in the past, or how you know vote counting goes in North Carolina and the rules about absentee versus same day vote, number one, should we assume that North Carolina gets called on election night? And number two, what does the count look like? What should we be expecting in terms of, as the numbers start to come in, what they may or may not tell us?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think first and foremost, for those of us that have been studying North Carolina politics for some time now, I think the key thing to realize is the bulk, the majority of the votes will be cast before Election Day. So we have two methods of early voting in North Carolina. You can use absentee by mail ballots, which has actually been delayed now.
Right.
So that's an issue. But the vast majority of North Carolinians will probably cast their ballots in a 2.5 week period before Election Day. Now, in 2008, the Obama campaign used that to their advantage. They banked ballots to where they had such a substantial lead going into Election Day. Republicans did not know what hit them until the vote started getting counted. That parity between Democratic dominance of early in-person voting versus Republicans shifting to Election Day, that's actually been subtly shifting to where now it's pretty much even between the two parties in terms of voting early. Republicans still have a slight edge in terms of voting on Election Day. So the first dump of votes after 7:30 or whenever the polls officially close in this state will likely be the early votes. There'll be some time because state law has changed to now where they can't count them in the afternoon and then post them immediately. They have to wait till the polls officially close and then start counting the
early votes. Is that new from 2020?
It is.
Okay, so it will be slower then, no doubt, than 2020, or no, you don't think so?
Well, it'll be slightly slower. We were concerned because it went into effect in 2022 with the U.S. Senate election, and we were forewarning everybody, don't expect that immediate dump at 7:30.
Right.
Give it some time. It was actually probably a little under an hour when most of the counties had reported their early votes and were starting to then post their Election Day stuff. So it went fairly smooth.
Okay.
Interestingly.
Okay. Now, obviously, it's a much lower turnout in a midterm than in the presidential, but the counties are, to your point, the counties have had practice. So this is something they're preparing for and know, okay, we're probably going to get X number more ballots. How do we make sure we can get through all of it. Okay.
Right. And I think one of the things, you know, certainly watching a county like New Hanover might give us some clues. I'm also really interested in a surrounding suburban county to Mecklenburg County, which is home to Charlotte, called Cabarrus County.
Oh, I love Cabarrus County.
Cabarrus County is a high growth population county. It has undergone a pretty significant shift. It used to be heavily Republican. Now it is literally coin toss kind of dynamics. And if you see a county like Cabarrus still in coin toss, and then look at a Union County, which is also right next door to Mecklenburg, and if there's a shaving off of the Republican vote in Union County, maybe it's not 65-35, maybe it's 62-38, or, you know, something crazy like 60-40 Republican. That means Democrats have really gotten their votes out, have maybe shifted some dynamics to their favor. And tell me what the turnout rate is going to be.
Right.
And I think we'll start to get a pretty good picture painted, you know, 9:30, maybe by 10 o'clock. You know, the stragglers tend to be in this state, Mecklenburg County, which is a huge portion. It'll be about 11, maybe 12% of the statewide vote. Durham County could be, you know, another county that's going to have huge Democratic votes coming out of it. So it's pockets of places, but the picture tends to get painted fairly quickly.
And to your point, because now Republicans have, since 2020, have seemed to be more comfortable with voting early.
Yes.
And now Donald Trump has even changed his language about this, saying like, still don't love it, but all right, whatever. If you want to do it, fine. But I don't like it, but okay. That we shouldn't expect sort of a blue wave, an early blue number, and then as the night moves on, the red gets mixed in. So you're saying, right. Well, the way it looks with the early vote dumped in is likely how it's going to look even once the regular vote comes in.
Yeah, I don't think there will be this tectonic shift from the early votes to election day. I think it'll be much more muted. It'll probably be within a couple of percentage points, you know, between what happens on early voting versus what happens on election day. But that's just an early, you know, hypothesis that I've been proven wrong before. It could be wrong this time.
What do you do on election night? Where are you? Are you in the just locked in a room with spreadsheets?
So this semester, I'm not teaching on Tuesdays. I've got a presentation to give at noon in Charlotte, and then I will likely go to one of the local TV stations and just camp out there and, you know, stay until they either kick me out or I fall asleep on a cot, you know, in studio. But I'm like everybody else. I'm just sitting there hitting the State Board of Elections.
Refresh.
And watching some of those key counties that I think, you know, can we get an early sense of what's happening? Mm. I think you can.
I can't let you go without talking about the other big race in your state, which is getting national attention, the governor's race there. A question we get asked a lot, I'm sure you have been asked this a lot, which is, can a down ballot race, in this case, a governor's race, have an impact on the top of the ticket? And the argument goes something like this. Democrats saying the Republican candidate for governor, Mark Robinson, is so controversial and is trailing in the polls so significantly that it may have the impact of actually hurting Donald Trump.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we normally talk about presidential coattails.
That's
pulling
right.
In the bottom of the ticket towards that party that wins at the top of the ticket. we may see gubernatorial coattails and, you know, kind of in reverse, you know, helping to pull Harris in if Stein is able to pull out a significant win. And by significant win, I mean something greater than 4 percentage points of a victory, margin of victory. I mean, anything at 5 points or more in this state is considered
an
absolute blowout. Yeah. It's a landslide. It's a dynamic that we have not truly seen since 08. And I think, you know, the question in my mind is, how influential are Republicans for Harris also going to be Republicans for Stein? And, you know, that Nikki Haley primary voter who cast a vote for Haley, even though she had dropped out in the presidential primary, I think that that's kind of an untapped research point to say, if those folks are truly against Trump, are they also truly against Robinson, which it appears to be? And what down ballot effect does that have? You know, not just for all the other races, attorney general, superintendent of public instruction, lieutenant governor, but state legislative races as well. The maps portend in North Carolina to Republican potential supermajorities, which means even if Stein wins, if Republicans control both chambers with supermajorities, they can do whatever they want and override his veto.
Yeah,
I think that dynamic, you know, the untapped Republicans for Harris, Republicans for Stein dynamic is something we need to be paying more close attention to over the next several weeks.
Here's where I kind of come down on this. I'd love to get whether you think I'm way off on this, but I can understand if I'm a state legislative candidate, my worry as a Republican that what Robinson is doing is painting the entire party in right as extremist, and that you are, if you're for Robinson as a state senator or state legislator, then you must believe the same things that he does. And he's, even though the some things that he says are so over the top that you've never heard anybody else say that, he's unique in that sense. He's representative of the party brand. So I can absolutely see your point about it really hurting Republican legislative candidates. What I wonder though is whether, because he is so out there, and in some ways, you know, the Stein campaign, it feels like every week is up with another ad of Mark Robinson saying something incredibly incendiary, that he's now seen as sort of a caricature, like, well, that's not Donald Trump. Like, you know, Mark Robinson, he's his kind of own crazy, but he's not like Donald Trump doesn't. He's not like that. So I could also see Republicans or Republican leaning voters going, yeah, I'm going to vote for Josh Hine. He seems like sane in a way, but I still like Donald Trump. Do you see what I'm saying? So that's where that crossover becomes challenging for me to see, because I can see a lot of Republicans basically still justifying that Trump is not Mark Robinson, and that they can feel okay voting for both. It's not as dissonant as it may seem.
And I think for most of us studying North Carolina politics, I think that is the conventional wisdom.
Okay.
That indeed, you know, they may not be super enthralled with Trump, but they'll vote for him because party loyalty, and then they bounce over to Stein. That's the natural environment that North Carolina politics has been playing over several presidential election cycles. Here's my slight contrarian.
Okay.
I don't know what to make
like
of this
it. I love
dynamic
it.
At play.
Yeah.
So you've got Trump, you've got Mark Robinson. We also have a very MAGA Republican superintendent of public instruction. It is a race that oftentimes doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but this year, the slate of Republicans as MAGA Republicanism, as Trump Republicanism, has really taken over that side of the ballot. And in combination with so many dimensions of Robinson's statement, Michelle Morrow's statements about public education, and then how does Donald Trump handle himself over the next 7 weeks towards November, you may have a situation where that side of the ballot becomes for a moderate Republican who is usually a party loyalist, that side becomes so toxic that they think, okay, I can't do it this year. I can't vote on that side of the ballot. I'm going to have to switch to the Democratic side. And that shift, combined with those persuadable voters, I mean, if you start to see Trump, Robinson, and Morrow all lined up in an ad as...
That's what I was going to ask you. Is anybody doing that? And if there were someone to do it, who would it benefit? Because on Josh Stein campaign, look, of course he wants Kamala Harris to win, but his number one priority is for Josh Stein to win, right? So does that benefit him to put Donald Trump in ads? Probably not, because he needs Trump voters.
Right.
So who runs those ads that say, if you think you're voting, you know, if you think voting for Trump means he's not as crazy as these other people, you're wrong. Like, does the Democratic Party do that? Does Harris do that?
I think, and I have no understanding or expectations that this may happen, but if it did, it's probably a third party special interest group. You know, Americans for America.
Yes. Kind of. That makes sense. Yeah.
And let them tag all three together, literally lumping all of the down ballot Republicans together. And then that kind of frees up the candidates from saying, well, that's not my doing. That's a third party that we can't coordinate with. But all of us in North Carolina are kind of, we're subtly but quietly waiting for that ad to drop at some point in this cycle. If it doesn't, you know, maybe it doesn't need to, because some of the internal polling would show that it's already baked in.
Got it.
But at some point, I'm not going to be surprised if I flip on, you know, YouTube or cable TV and see this trifecta Republican attack ad against Republicans in that nature.
Okay, if you see one of those ads, especially if it's a digital ad, because obviously we can't track digital ads, will you take a screenshot and send it to me?
I will be more than
happy. And because you are the kind of dork that I am that would be so excited to see it and then look for the funder, right? Yeah. You'll look at the end for who paid for it.
North Carolinians for exactly. Saying North Carolina or something.
I know you would do. I'm sure the same person that during events, like especially live events where they have political ads, I always make whoever I'm watching it with in my household hit pause because I want to see which ad is this. Okay, well, is this a Dem-sponsored ad? Is this a Republican ad? And they're just like, can we not? Can we just watch the game? Absolutely not. No, I'm watching the game for the ads.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. The game for the game, but.
Yeah, yeah. You know what my wife and my 19-year-old son have to suffer through.
They love us for it, Michael. They love us for it. This has been fantastic. I really, really appreciate you taking this time to talk with me about the most interesting state in 2024. Will continue to be a fascinating state going forward. And thank you for all the work you do. And if people are not following you yet, how can they follow your work?
Yeah. The main outlet that I really kind of promote stuff on is a blog called oldnorthstatepolitics.com. I'm also on X at Bowtie Politics. You can probably find me on any social media venue with some combination of Bowtie and Politics out there.
That is great. And to the listeners here, seriously, you've heard this man. He knows everything about it. All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
We can do this, right? We can hold on for another 50-ish days.
We got this.
We got it. All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review. Or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpoliticalreport.com/subscribe. While you're there, you can use the discount code OD10 to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thanks, and talk to you soon.